time for Lickin' On Lending.
Welcome, everybody. Good to have you with us.
Welcome to Lickin' On Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news, all related to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Transformational Mortgage Solutions. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now here's your host of Lickin' On Lending, David Lickin.
Let's begin.
Welcome, everybody. It's Monday, September 16th, 2019. We say that for all of those of you that are listening on a downloaded basis. Welcome to another Lickin' On Lending podcast. This podcast is created by mortgage professionals. It is for mortgage professionals, and we're grateful to have you as our listener. Our commitment to you is to bring you timely information in an audio format that you can listen to anytime and anywhere. Today's hot topic is really kicking off a series on leadership. I'm really excited about a series of podcasts. Now, we'll interrupt it with different things we have coming going on. But for the rest of the year, we're really going to focus in on leadership. And today, we have Ken Jones, who's president of Resex Warehouse Lending, a division of United Bank. And he's on the program today to not talk about warehouse lending, but specifically talk about expanding your business through effective leadership. And it comes down to what he refers to as three pillars of successful leadership. We're going to be talking about that in the Hot Topic segment, so stay tuned to the Hot Topic part of the podcast. Anyway, we're proud to be a part of the Industry Syndicate. Check it out, industrysyndicate.com. You can check out all the podcasters that are on there. We started out, we are the only ones. Now we got a whole crowded field of podcasters, and it's all great content. Encourage you to find the one that takes care of your needs, but we're thrilled to have you as our listener. Anyway, Mitch Cohen, the Director of Public Relations and Marketing and Communications of Black Knight, sent some over information. He says, as you recall, last week, the Freddie Mac rate survey ticked down below 3.49%, and the population increased, and the high-quality refinance candidates surged over 11.7 million. Well, the 30-year average inched back up, as we all know, in the mortgage business, to 3.56. And just like that, nearly 2 million borrowers fell off of the refinance population. So isn't it interesting how rates can have such a dramatic effect on it? I tell you, you need to check out what Black Knight puts out in their data and research. Again, servicing, what is it, over 70% of all loans in America? I'm not sure if that's 100% correct. I double check it, but I think it is. Over 70% of all loans are being serviced on the MSP, Black Knight MSP system. So they got some pretty good data, and they have some great analytics. I want to say a special thank you to our sponsors. Let's start off by thanking Black Knight. We were just talking about their intelligence platform. They have an actionable intelligence platform that can deliver data that drives growth and reduces costs. So go to BlackKnightInc.com. Check them out. Also, the Mortgage Bankers Association of America. Pleased to have a partnership with them, along with the Community Mortgage Lenders of America. So both these associations will give you the opportunity to go to conferences and network very effectively. Now, the MBA is definitely the granddaddy of them all, but the Community Mortgage Lenders of America coordinates with the MBA on lobbying. So a lot of great stuff there. We're looking forward to having some guests on from that group. Also, Open Mortgage, a leading buyer of reverse mortgages and home of some of the top LOs. And we'll be hearing from Scott in just a minute with the Science of Sales. As well as Finastra, who's got the mortgage bot solution, automatically addresses compliance issues. But the thing I'm really excited about what they're doing so well is their point of sale technology, that app they have. They have an app that's going to be just so effective at allowing you to compete with that other company out there. We all know what it is. It's got a rocket associated with it. But anyway, and then also we're thrilled to have Resex Warehouse Lending, a division of United Bank, as a lender. Again, Ken here, Ken Jones, our Hot Topic guest, is with them, as well as Lenders One and the Mortgage Collaborative. Both of these co-ops create competitive advantages for both lenders and vendor members. And also want to say thank you to Velma for their support of our podcast. We use their platform for emailing out all the information, as well as Knowledge Cube, providing fun and easy training for mortgage lenders, as well as Vidyard, the powerful video communications technology enabling you to connect with your customers. And then when it comes down to making decisions, we need to be making them faster at a lower cost. That's why we have as a sponsor, and pleased to have as a sponsor, AI Assist, powered by Conversica. Listen to Roman Venfield's interview on July 15th of this year. And we're talking about marketing your business through artificial intelligence. This conversational AI, folks, is just amazing. Also, I want to say a special thank you to Alice, Andy, Alan, and Joe for their contributions to this podcast each and every week. Let's get over to Rob Van Ramphorst with this week's MBA Mortgage Minute.
Hi, I'm Rob Van Ramphorst. Welcome to the Mortgage Minute and the latest news from the Mortgage Bankers Association. Last week, the Senate Banking Committee heard testimony from the key architects of the Trump administration's plan to reform the country's housing finance system and end the conservatorship of the GSEs. Witnesses were Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, HUD Secretary Ben Carson, and FHFA Director Mark Calabria. Senators mostly agreed that the current state of affairs when it comes to the Treasury Department's backing of the GSEs was risky for taxpayers and untenable, and both sides of the aisle debated how to unwind the two enterprises. Also last week, MBA, together with other key trade associations, submitted comments to HUD on the FHA's reproposed draft of the annual certification required of FHA-approved lenders. The letter strongly supports HUD's changes to the original proposal, which reflects recommendations made by MBA. In responding to the latest proposal, the organizations made minor recommendations to align definitions in the annual certification language with already existing definitions in the FHA handbook. In addition, the letter requested that FHA clarify that lenders need not redisclose previously self-reported issues when signing the certification. That's it for this week. Thanks for joining me.
Good job, Rob. Appreciate you taking the time to supply us that soundbite of what's going on. You're not a member of Mortgage Action Alliance at the MBA. Please check it out, Mortgage Action Alliance. I was on the app this weekend sending off notifications to senators and legislators about some of the issues that are important. It makes it so easy when you have that app on your phone, on your smart device. Sign up for Mortgage Action Alliance. Search for that app in the App Store, be sure to download it and use it. And you don't have to be a member of the MBA to have your voice be heard. How about that? So cool. Very grateful for all that they do. Yeah, I was thinking as he was talking about HUD Secretary Ben Carson. And the other thing that was in the news is, hey, we got these important things like that. But you know what? Everyone was really obsessing on Ben Carson's $31,000 dining room set that was supposedly his wife or he ordered for his office. I go, I'm like, what the heck do you need a dining $31,000 dining room? But they made such a big deal of it. Anyway, he canceled the order. It's all that. Lots of thoughts about Ben Carson, his leadership within the administration, and very interested in hearing him speak here at the MBA, the National MBA Conference here in Austin, Texas. Coming up, he'll be speaking. Personally, big fan of Ben Carson. Met him in the green room in Fox Studios, and I like this guy. Master of understatement, probably the master of being quiet. He's a good listener. We'll see what he has to say when he's here with his prepared comments. But talking about prepared comments, let's run over to Les Parker with a macro view of the markets, the TM Spotlight. Les?
TM Spotlight Soundbite is brought to you by Ainsworth Advisors, Waterloo. Who was defeated? Who won the war? Mario promised to buy bonds forevermore. Who is facing their Waterloo? France, Japan, Germany? The answer is the G4 central banks broadly and Mario Draghi, the soon-to-be ex-president of the European Central Bank, specifically. The woke market sees declining growth and low inflation from excess debt. The market can address it by repricing assets, but the central banks don't trust the untethered market forces. Central bankers cannot create inflation nor stimulate growth, but they sure can sound big and powerful. The good intentions of central bankers create moral hazard. Is Mario finally facing his Waterloo? These views are my own. Go to tmspotlight.com to subscribe to my daily newsletter.
Coming out, I was talking to Les over this week, and I was talking about the songs you come up with. How do you do that? And he said in his newsletter, which you could go out and check out at tmspotlight.com, he writes and it gives you a hint about the song, and he has you guessing. So you don't actually get to listen to it in the soundbite, but you get to listen to it here on Licking and Lending. Good job, Les Parker. Appreciate you and Gary Canterbone turning out great stuff each and every week. Joe Farr, good to have you on the podcast again. Let's get an update from you on what's on the economic calendar this week that could be messing with us.
Well, it's the Fed, but you know, so far it's the drone strikes on the Saudi Arabian oil fields are being good to us. MBS prices are up. about 25 basis points. Unfortunately, the stock market's down, but that's kind of how things have been rolling, where what's good for the MBS market's not good for the stock market. Iran's being blamed for it by some in the U.S. Supposedly, there's some data to back that up, but it sure raises the question of what might happen next and how retaliation may be carried out. So that's got the market kind of spooked, and so the sell-off in stocks is good for bonds.
Yeah, maybe a good day to lock a load.
Yeah, last week was a bad week, as I'm sure everyone knows. MBS prices fell about 130 basis points during the week. Like I was mentioning, what's good for MBS is not good for stocks and vice versa. The stock market was up about 400 points last week on the Dow. And that just continued the trend so far for September. Today's about the first day after September 3rd that we've been up on MBS prices. So it's been a tough week. I mean, part of it should have been good for, I mean, the ECB meeting should have been good for MBS prices. Dropping rates was, actually what they did was pretty much as expected, but at least the ECB confirmed that they were installing a new QE program. Should have been good for bonds and was initially, but by the time the day was over, all the benefit that occurred early had been reversed, and in fact, that was a down day. You know, Brexit has been a big part of the news lately. Last week, I couldn't even begin to tell you all the legislative maneuvering things that were going on. But in the end, it looks as though the chance of a no-deal Brexit on October 31st has diminished some, which may be good for the market, good for stocks. But there's still a lot going on inside the legal maneuvering that's going on in Great Britain to have an impact on markets in the weeks to come. The data that came out last week was mixed for interest rates. Core CPI rose more than expected, and retail sales without autos was a little lower than expected. And both of those things are going to weigh on the Fed this week, which is going to be the big driver for MBS prices, I think, this week. 25 basis point cut in Fed funds rates expected, although the expectation for that has fallen some. It is now at 65%, whereas last week it was up to 95%. You know, part of that, I think, was following the rise in core CPI. And looking longer term, you know, the Fed expects that 25 basis point cut. But they'll really be looking for guidance as to what's going on in future rate cuts. And I looked out in the last week, the expectation of a third rate cut this year has fallen from about 50% to 15%. So people aren't expecting as much help from the Fed as it relates to stimulating the market than what had been the case just a week ago. So watch for the statement to come out at 2 on Wednesday. And 2 Eastern time, and the press conference will follow that at 2:30. Then the housing, there's a lot of housing data to come out next week, or this week, Dave. Home builder sentiment comes out tomorrow. Housing starts on Wednesday and existing home sales on Thursday. And even though we've seen a lot of volatility in interest rates, you know, you would have expected that the drop in rates that occurred would have been good for existing home sales, but there is a small drop expected from the July level.
Interesting.
And that's it.
That's it. Yep. Existing home sales. Well, we're in the seasonal, starting to slow down a little bit, but
yeah,
we'll start seeing some of that data show up there. But it's going to be interesting with interest rates bumping up, taking 2 million prospective refinance people out of the market, people or Americans out of the refinance market. Interesting to see what the volume levels are going to do this fall. And are we going to find ourselves in a situation where we're struggling to get some business in the door? Well, our next segment, Scott Gordon of Open Mortgage, talks about the science of sales.
How do you really feel about realtors? Are they your referral source or your business partner? Hey everyone, Scott Gordon here with a bit of sales science. It's often said that facts don't have feelings, but behavioral scientists are discovering more and more that the way we feel shapes our reality more than facts. So facts may not have feelings, but for many people, feelings are facts. What does this have to do with realtors? Well, let me ask you. When you think of realtors as referral partners, are you really thinking of them as referral partners or referral sources? This is a very important question to ask yourself. Every action you take toward those relationships will stem from your answer. If you feel that your realtors are sources of referrals, your actions are going to be very different. A source is not a partnership. You're going to invest the minimum amount of time into a source in order to extract the maximum profit. The problem with that is your source is a human being, and they are going to feel and perceive your actions. On the other hand, if you feel that your realtors are your partners, you're going to approach them differently. Partnerships are based on establishing and providing value. There are countless ways to provide value in your relationship, but they mean little if you aren't really feeling it. So, how do you feel about your realtors? Your answer says everything. If this sounds too good to be true, it's not. It's just the science of sales.
Good job, Scott. Love the science of sales. Got some more people calling me and saying, hey, by the way, I love that science of sales segment. If you want to get a message out on the podcast, I encourage you to check out our website. Love to help you get your message out. I love that one. Scott's getting well known for the science of sales segment. Alice Alvey is here, and I always wanted to do the old Johnny Carson, and now here's Alice, CMB Vice President of Education Training at Union Home Mortgage. Alice Alvey, what you got for the legislative update, my friend? Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, well, you know, that was a great show. I think we own the old, you know, you can get the collection and go back and watch all of those. There were just some, I mean, the whole idea of drinking and smoking on TV.
I know. Boy, talk about a change, how things have changed. Isn't that the truth? Amazing.
So, yeah, a whole different world today. All right, so believe it or not, Congress is actually getting a couple of things done, and one interesting thing that passed the House on September 10th, which I thought was really interesting. It's House Bill 2852, and this is a simple piece of legislation to allow all appraisers to be eligible to conduct FHA appraisals. So in other words, kind of do away with that FHA certification and just go with, hey, if you're properly licensed, you know, at the state level, then why can't they also conduct an FHA appraisal? It really would help the market, you know, take away a lot of red tape that goes on with FHAs. Obviously, you have the other side of the camp that gets concerned about the quality and making sure the appraisers understand all the nuances of the additional repairs required. But, you know, and that's easy enough to teach, if you ask me. So I think it'll be interesting to see if anything happens. That was presented actually by Brad Sherman, a Democrat out of California, called the Home Buyer Assistance Act. Another bill that came out that was passed last week, really not directly related to many of us who listen in, because this is for low to moderate income tenants in multifamily. But I do like to watch that market. I think it's all worth it for all of us to really be aware when the Rural Housing Service is going to be expanding their products. And I think there is a market there to at least understand on how it impacts single family as well. So that's HR 360, also passed the House. Quick note, today is your last day to comment on the QM rule. We talked about this on a previous show. The qualified mortgage definition under the Truth in Lending Act, everything has to be posted by today to be able to get your two cents on. Really, one of the fundamentals is, do we still need to have a 43 DTI as a guideline for a qualified mortgage or non-qualified mortgage? For those of you who are trying to remember how all this works, the biggest thing is that right now an approved eligible or accept from Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac automatically meets the qualified mortgage definition. Well, we have to come up with something that's in writing that we would say this works for all loans and is not dependent on Fannie or Freddie's automated underwriting decision. Would just work independently. And we're all for that at some point on some risky products there's a DTI consideration, but we certainly don't want that across the board on all our products. So there's lots to look at there. The MBA, I have to check. I meant to check this morning. I believe they should make sure they have theirs published by today. There's lots of things, but please make sure that you reach out and comment about the need for this, that it affects roughly $260 billion in originations that would now be a challenge as to how to determine that they are a qualified mortgage and the borrower is demonstrating they have the ability to repay. So read other folks' comments that are posted. That'll help guide your own and look for the MBAs. That's my quick update for today, Dave. I'll send it back to you.
Good job. Really appreciate it, Alice. Be sure to say hi to, well, if we're looking forward to having Bill Cosgrove on the podcast on leadership. I can't wait for you to nail that down, so get that scheduled. Or have we already gotten that scheduled?
I'm still
working
on it.
I think we do.
Okay.
Oh, you're working on it. Good, good, good. Keep working on it, Alice. You do so awesome. Good. Appreciate you so much. Appreciate your contributions for more than 10 years to this podcast. Very much appreciated. Alice runs training there at Union Home Mortgage, and we're always looking for good LMS or learning management systems. And I want you guys to consider Knowledge Group. If you're looking for a fun and easy training technology, check out our friends at Knowledge Group.
Hey, Nathan here from the Knowledge Cube. Do you need to teach a course? Have you considered maybe using the Socratic method? See, it's a process of using questions that engage learners to question their assumptions in order to eliminate contradictions. The primary goal is not to have listeners try to answer unanswerable questions, but to get them to develop critical thinking and to keep them engaged in your topic. Have you got some training to do? Check out the Knowledge Cube for fun and easy video-based training for the mortgage professionals out there. And it's all powered by a smart digital platform.
Check out KnowledgeCoop.com. Alan Pollack, good to have you here with this week's Weekly Tech Update.
Hey,
should have
good
done
to be
the
here.
Same. Johnny Carson, and here's Alan. But I guess that would get a little old after a while. So are you sitting there holding a cigarette, smoking, giving us a report? Boy, can you believe that? That's a foreign concept today. Imagine having a talk show host holding a cigarette and drinking, I don't know, anyway.
Back then, it was a dirty martini, so they had olives for lunch.
That's right. Oh, hey, what's he got for tech update? Let's move to the modern world here.
Yes, let's do it. So today's a good one. First, I want to start with the Digital Mortgage Conference coming up this weekend, starting everyone starts checking in on Sunday, and we've got Monday, Tuesday, and part of Wednesday maybe with some fantastic content. I've already downloaded the app and gone through the content. There are a number of companies that I've never heard of, so that's the good thing. There's some new technology, new Silicon Valley money coming in. And I think in addition, there's a bunch of companies that I'm excited to see some updates. So if you happen to be in Vegas, you want to be a last minute registration, you want to head on over. And if you're going to be there, I would love to spend some couple minutes and say hi to you. But either way, that is coming up starting on Sunday. So that's a good thing. The next is, there's been a lot of news today on a company called Simplest. And the reason why I wanted to talk about this for a moment, Dave, is it's unique because, we always talk about QA or QM versus non-QM. We talk about, how credit requirements are sort of expanding, non-traditional lending. Well, anyways, what they're doing is they're brokering loans, but they've created technology where a borrower can that is not necessarily qualified by traditional means. They could be self-employed. They could have a different financial makeup. They're not part of the traditional workforce. This will qualify borrowers and help match them. There's 25 lenders built into their system right now, some regional, some local banks, and they also have refinancing options. So if you're interested in learning more about Simplest, you want to check that out. Great, fantastic use of technology. If I was to sum it up, David, right, in the non-traditional way, let's say, it's a pricing and eligibility engine that has a bunch of different guidelines, and they've got a bunch of content and data that they're able to validate. And you collect the right amount of data, non-traditional data, let's say, you have the ability to have different things in there. And then, of course, you partner with different banks and credit unions, and you could have or lenders rather, and you can have their rates and programs in there. So if you're looking to integrate or you need that, you have certain originators that need that extra type of product, then that's something you want to look at. And there's a few folks out there very similar to Simplest. This one, Dave, I thought this was pretty good. Better.com. They just did $160 million Series C round of funding, and they made an announcement that they are going to be opening in Charlotte, North Carolina. And they are currently hiring sales, software engineering, partnerships, and different operational positions. And they expect in the next few years to hire up to 1,000 different people. So I brought that up because I know that there's some of my friends alone have worked for one or two different companies, and there's been some layoffs. No indication of where the industry is going, just that certain companies make changes from time to time. Anyways, Better.com is out there. You want to check it out. They do have active listings right now, even for underwriting positions. And then, David, getting back to the topic we spent a few weeks on, and I've brought up different points. Last week was security. We talked about build versus buy. There's a myth out there. Remember, the new acronym is DWTUT, decide where to use technology. And there's this myth out there. The myth is that you can use Salesforce to build your own system. And I'm sure you've heard it. I've run across it multiple times, and no doubt you can be successful with Salesforce. But I just wanted to talk about that for a moment today. As we look at the different technology solutions coming out, we look at, right, we've heard plenty of times death by a thousand cuts, how people build for different technology. And you consider, do you build or do you buy or do you partner? Salesforce, they just made a big announcement about their new mobile platform. They do have the ability, especially if you're using them as your CRM, to institutionalize more of your process in their platform. And where I'm going with this is I want to talk about how it can be difficult. And what's difficult about it is that you have another piece of technology where you still need a technology team. So if you're looking at this saying, hey, I don't need to partner with certain other technology vendors, I'm going to have people that know Salesforce. I can find them online. Upwork is a site where you can grab quick people, or yeah. I have some staff that knows it. And we're going to build an app. We're going to build our own system. There's certain things you still have to keep in mind. Some of those are the fact that you're inserting a brand new piece of technology and process in the middle of a transaction that would usually flow from point A to point B. So you've pushed the point B transaction to point C, and you've implemented something in point B, meaning it's more complex to manage that transaction, meaning that there's more to debug, there's more hands touching a transaction, and then more importantly, it's the security. You're actually taking data and you're putting it en route into another system. So all of those things considered, and what you're looking for, it's possible that you can be very successful. And recently I saw a Salesforce app that actually integrated with multiple systems and was not bad at all. And I also worked with a lender about a year and a half ago that put together an app that went through Salesforce, and they remodeled the data on their own. What wound up happening is they had to acquire more systems to make everything sort of massage it right, and they created more work, and now they're looking to get off that platform. But anyways, you can be successful. But it may be better, as you think about building versus buying versus partnering, to figure out what your partners are doing, and would you be better off spending the money to partner and advance someone's roadmap? The reason why is you still need a technology staff. You may be better off managing the project rather than building and maintaining the project. But beyond that, if your partners or new vendors come out with these features in more of a substantial way that you're using them today, then what you built may be throwaway. So consider those things. It's not a myth buster, but it is a myth that you can be highly successful building apps on Salesforce. Consider the right place, the right time, and the right amount of capital to do so.
Yeah.
And beyond that, David, there'll be definitely lots of new stuff this weekend at Digital Mortgage.
Yep. I can't wait to get a report from Digital Mortgage from you next week. Be good.
Sounds good.
So when is that Digital Mortgage conference? It starts on what day in Vegas?
It starts Sunday.
Starts on Sunday. Well, good. Have a good time. Safe travels there. Look forward to hearing more. This whole Salesforce thing, some of these apps, these CRMs take so much support. We went with HubSpot, and, we dialed it back to more of the simpler version because there's more here, and it takes a staff of 1, 2, 3 people to be able to really make this thing really effective. So we just dialed it back to the simple version. Sometimes simple is better, especially when it comes to cost and overall effectiveness.
That's a fantastic point.
Yep. So true. It's learned from experience. So I was talking to one of our clients on this very point on a CRM. They're looking at it. They go, we're going to go to Salesforce. I go, why is that? It's because it's the biggest. It's the most widely used. I said, have you thought about this to support that? And they go, yeah, we did, but it shouldn't be that bad. And then I said, why don't you do some research on it? So I'll be interested in what they come back with. I need to get them over to you. Anyway, thank you so much, Alan. Appreciate you being here each and every week with the Tech Update. And look forward to these kind of giving us a little bit of a flavor on what you're hearing from the floor. Hopefully you can break away from the conference to be here with us. Appreciate you, Alan. Thank you so much. Folks, let's talk about our friends at Finastra. Dan Putney and I are good friends. I like this guy so much. And, there's many things about Finastra. They've got all the banking systems that are out there, so many products, third largest fintech company in the world. But the product I'm encouraging a mortgage, especially the independent mortgage bankers, to look at is their point-of-sale technology. You can learn about it by going to our website, look at our lending website, go under advertisers, and listen to our recording of Eric Schwab, who is with Bank of Midwest, and they're doing a great job. And what's interesting about that interview, it's in the smaller rural markets where they're having some of the best success with this point-of-sale app. It is a great competitor to any of the leading technology out there. Check it out at finastra.com. Andy Schell, good to have you, the Profit Doctor, in the house. Always fun to hear your perspective. And Andy and I were going to do barbecue this weekend, and then we switched it over to an airplane show. We hit the local air show, and you're just so busy with this doctorate stuff. You've got to finish this up so you start having fun.
Well, and I really wanted to go see you at the airplane show, and I actually forgot about that I had the dissertation defense on Wednesday along with a class that I teach on Wednesday, and I had to prepare more for both, so I spent all weekend working. I didn't have my calendar keeping up with my activities. So this Wednesday is Mortgage Accounting Webinar series number two. So this Wednesday, through the Mortgage Bankers Association, you can listen to how to do loan level accounting, how to know what your profit per branch is, how to know what your profit per originator is and your profit per product. You know, this is really fundamental and essential for success in mortgage banking. And you don't have to have a super high-end system to do it. You can do it with QuickBooks. But there are some really good high-end systems out there that the two leaders are LoanVision and Accounting for Mortgage Bankers. And during this webinar, we're going to talk about some of the things that go boom in the night, the things that that are, whoops, oh, you mean I'm going to go to jail now? So we want to cover those items. So I'll give you a quick preview. One of the things is a fairly complicated topic to get your head around, and it's called net funding escrow. So what net funding escrow means is that when a customer comes to the closing table and they bring $5,000 to pay for future payments of hazard insurance, taxes, whatever else, and then we use that $5,000 and actually lower the amount of our warehouse line borrowing in order to fund the loan, well, okay, so we did that, and at month end, we have to segregate those funds. Actually, in California, you have to segregate it for every single transaction. So people don't realize that this is a rule. It's actually a requirement. This is a fiduciary event. Holding somebody, when you're a business and a customer gives you their money to hold for them for their future benefit, that is a fiduciary event. And a fiduciary event means that the funds have to be segregated. You have to actually put their money in a separate cash account from yours. Now, in California, you get in big bad trouble if you don't do this right. And we've helped people get it fixed. And this webinar will show you how to identify this, how to set it up so that you don't have this problem. Now, the other problem that is sort of an unknown item that potentially creates the big boom in the night, and that is collecting first payments. So some lenders go, well, we don't ever get first payments. Well, you probably do, just that your accounting department takes care of it.
Yeah,
if the purchase by the investor is after the cutoff date to give 2 weeks' notice to the customer, then the lender's going to get the first payment and the investor gets the second payment. When that happens, when you collect that first payment, that means that when you call the customer, you have to follow the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And you are supposed to make certain that the people who call the customer as a debt collector, because it's the money that's owed to you and your business, you have to actually send them to training and document that they've had training. And also, if you don't ever collect it, that's a first payment default. And that's a repurchase risk for the life of the loan.
Yes.
And if you don't collect the payment, the whole payment gets written off. So it's a loss, and it's a regulatory violation, and it's if you don't collect them with your accounting people who are making these phone calls, say, hey, send us your payment under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act requirements. So net funding escrow, first payment collection are things that people don't even think about. But we do in accounting, and we talk about it in the webinar, and we show people how to do it right the first time because we don't want the surprises that surface from stuff like this. So there you go, Dave. There's a preview of the webinar and some important information people need to know. As stupid as it sounds, you can get in trouble if you don't do this stuff right.
Yeah. No, especially when you come in with borrower's money, they get a little fussy about that and how it's handled. It's really, really important. That's a great point. It's a great reminder. I'd forgotten that. We advise on a lot of different issues, but that's why you need the consulting services of Andy Schell, CPA, CFF, CMB, and soon to be the PhD, Dr. Andy Schell.
Yes, sir.
The Profit Doctor with
this week,
a real
hopefully.
Official title, Doctor. How cool
hopefully
is that?
Hopefully this week. You bet.
Yeah. Someone just wrote me and said, hey, Lincoln, you don't talk about the digital business card anymore. Did you stop using that? Was that a fad? No, it works, folks. It really, really, really does. It's something that I use regularly. Don't even carry business cards with me. Okay, so I may carry some old wrinkled up ones I have in my wallet for the fishbowl when you're walking around the conference. You throw it in there and see if you'll win something. But anyway, as far as the day-to-day operations, I've gone to the digital business card. Check it out on our website, digital business card. Look at our lending, upper right-hand corner, the digital business card. Nice thing is you can track who when someone opens it, you know what's going on. So appreciate you guys being regular listeners. This ends the regular weekly update, and now we're about ready to head into the Hot Topic segment. So without further ado, I want to welcome Ken Jones, president of ResX Warehouse Lending, a division of United Bank. He's on the program today to not necessarily talk just about warehousing. We may get into that a little bit. But to discuss the key topic of expanding your business through effective leadership. And it comes down to three defining pillars of success and leadership. But we're going to get into it. By the way, Ken brings over 25 years of experience. He's been a business owner. He's a leader in consumer finance, mortgage banking industry. And in his current position as president of ResX Warehouse Lending, division of United Bank, he brings just a wealth of experience and leadership. Ken joined the bank in 2017 to reestablish the bank's growth in warehouse lending. Ken, good to have you on the podcast, my friend.
Well, thanks, David. You know, in Northeast Florida, we got two things, hurricanes and jaguars. So today, everybody's sulking because of another jaguar's loss, but we're giving thanks again that the hurricane has spared our coast and stayed well offshore. So it's a good day.
Well, it is a good day. Sorry about the Jags and their loss, but there's a lot of people say. I like what you were saying to one of your friends. I got an email, and they said they've offered me a new job as the head coach. I think there's a lot of people think they could coach the Jags better than the current leadership there. But anyway, but you're doing a great job there at ResX and division of United Bank. But let's get into a little bit of your career as we get to know you and talk more about leadership, especially your comments. I want to talk about the beginning of your career, and I want to talk about the contribution where you started picking up some leadership tendencies. So how did you get into the business, intentionally or by accident? And then talk about your leadership journey a little bit.
Well, you know, I got into the warehouse business a little bit by accident. It was back in the 2008-2009 era, and we're sitting in a small community bank on the executive team, and the CEO said, you know, we need to make more money. And one of the ways we can do that is warehouse lending. And so he looked at me and he said, you're a mortgage guy. He said, go figure it out. So, you know, that was 10 years ago. We embarked on, figuring it out. We've had some great success. But beyond that, I want to talk today, you know, what I call the pillars of leadership. And, you know, throughout my career, I've had the opportunity to work with many successful leaders. And I think like all of us, you kind of pick up things and you forget things along the way, you know, some that are good and some that may be not so good. And I think, you know, throughout our careers, whether we look at in our career or in the sports world, we can surely reflect on some examples of those leaders that have been, you know, autocratic or those leaders that have been, you know, very positive. And, you know, each time, you know, everybody gets results, but it depends on how long those results last and how they're able to influence people. And in my career, I've been fortunate to work in both public companies and non-public companies, banks and non-banks. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is that, you know, no one style fits all. You know, you can't treat everybody the same. And that's particularly important in today's workforce. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, people were focused on climbing the corporate ladder, not to say that they're not today, but, you know, you sacrifice your health and your family for the good of the corporation. I worked for one organization that said, you know, when it was next man up or woman up for the opportunity for promotion, and if that required a physical relocation with your family and you said no, then you were terminated. I think in today's environment, people would reflect back on that and say, you know, okay, well, you know, I'll leave. You're not the type of employer that I want to work for. So I think that, you know, there's been a reshaping of people's thoughts and values over the years and their goals.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, today's workforce, I think you have to be much more sensitive to, you know, people's common values and create environments that encourage professional growth while at the same time providing flexibility and meeting people where they need to be. And we've seen some companies do some unique things. Working remote, that's not relatively a new paradigm, but, you know, working remote, bringing their pet or child to work. The company my son works for, he gets breakfast and lunch every day. you know, provided by the company. And then there's other companies like, you know, GE is just one example that provides unlimited vacation time. And so it really encourages people to, you know, balance life and work. And, you know, it's the employer kind of, managing costs, but at the same time trying to demonstrate, you know, kind of a quid pro quo. You know, it's a two-way street. And so I think before I get into, the pillars for success, I want to say, to me, at the foundation of everything is to be able to build trust as a leader, right?
Yeah,
and,
so true.
And I think that, trust kind of transcends every relationship that we engage in, whether it's work, marriage, friendship, dating, sales opportunity, coaching, and so on. And if you can't build and maintain trust, I think any relationship is doomed. And there's a guy that wrote a book by the name of, I might not get his last name correctly, Patrick Lencioni, right? And he writes about the five dysfunctions of a team.
Yeah, we're big fans of that book. I mean, in fact, I was on a coaching session with one of my clients. I do a lot of executive coaching management teams on the topic of leadership, but that's why we're kicking the series off, because there's just such a big need of it. And he's one of my go-to guys that I use virtually all of his material in helping people see that. And so I think it's really important. And so let's get into these three pillars that you mentioned to become a successful leader. Let's start off with the first one. I like the point of it, building at the speed of trust. Gabe Minton mentioned a book in his segment that we had on, probably a couple months ago now, and it's basically the speed of trust building, and it's the trust internet. If you can build trust on the internet sooner, faster, your e-commerce is going to be so much better. If you're looking at building and having a successful business relationship, the faster you can get to trust, which is relationship, you're better off. So let's start off with the first pillar that you talk about.
Sure. Yeah, I think creating a vision, right? Communication is really important. And whether you have a small team, I mean, I've managed groups as small as five and as many as 500. And to me, the most important goal is, you know, always to be consistently communicating a vision for the team. And that vision could be, you know, big picture of where we're going, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now, or it could be as simple as, you know, here's a particular project that we need to focus on and work on, but you have to be able to articulate and set that vision out. And, you know, you have to follow up with, you know, communication on progress and results along the way. And I like to do that in several ways. You know, you get your team meetings or books or videos or things like TED Talks are really great methods to engage a team. You know, in our warehouse business today, we monitor and track a lot of data. What that does is enables our team to be focused on our overall success. Let me tell you a quick story about, you know, creating a vision. You know, some time ago, I had a division of 20 offices, and I was promoted to this division, and unbeknownst to me, it had a horrible reputation with its state regulator. And
that's not a good thing. That's not good if you're banking.
60 days into the job, I was called to the state banking commissioner's office for a meeting. And I, you know how you remember some things of where you were and how you acted and so on. So I sat in this dimly lit conference room with folding tables and plastic chairs. And the elderly looking banking commissioner came in and sat between his deputies, and he looked at me and he said, "Young man, do you see those licenses hanging on the wall?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Then you either clean up your offices or I'll pick the licenses off your wall one by one. Do you have any questions?" I said, "No," and he adjourned the meeting.
That created a little bit of a clear vision, a little abrupt to the point, I guess.
But in creating the vision, you know, that wasn't my immediate goal, but it quickly became our immediate goal. And we put, you know, we got the team together, put a plan together to clean up the offices. And over the next 18 months, each employee knew when an exam was done, how many violations there were, what they were. And they also learned about the importance of communication and respect. And we went from having 200 violations per exam down to 5, and we went from, we were on a biannual rotation with the examiners, to an annual examination. So the point is that when you communicate and you rally people around a specific cause, you're generally going to get good results.
That's so true. Do you see some people within the mortgage lending space that are doing a good job on creating vision? We don't have to name any companies if you don't want to, but I think it's just so important in communicating the vision both internally, but then also it can be such a powerful marketing tool in creating your vision externally. I love that. Thoughts?
Sure. I do see, the nice thing about being in warehouse lending is you have a portfolio of companies. And so, you get to see the range of those that, espouse a vision.
One thing.
And those that are, focused otherwise. I think the second pillar for me, I don't want to kind of order these 1, 2, 3, but this is really an important one for me, is being vulnerable, right? And I think to be a good leader, you have to be vulnerable with your team. Being vulnerable doesn't mean that, means that I don't have all of the answers. I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to apologize if I've made a mistake. I'm not going to let pride dictate and say, well, I'm always right and you're wrong. And it says, I care about you as a person. And I've always felt there's no shame in a genuine apology. And I think when you can be vulnerable, it augments the potential to build trust. And it says, I value you and I appreciate you. And I think at the end of the day, right, that's what really drives us as human beings, is we want to be valued. We want to be appreciated. Sure, having a job or a title or a salary or an incentive plan, all of those things are important, but at the base is, I want to be valued and I want to be appreciated. And so I think to be able to get to that, you have to demonstrate a level of vulnerability.
Yeah, see, I couldn't agree with you more. And one of the things that Patrick Lencioni says in one of his books, that it's the ideal team player, he says that the three attributes he looks for in character of someone is someone that's hungry, humble, and smart. And there's a lot of smart people out there that are hungry, but the biggest thing that people struggle with is the humility part. And I think, which goes to your point of being vulnerable, is there's a component into that is humility, and vulnerability helps bring about, transparency, which is another thing that brings about the whole trust thing. So it's being real and talking to people. Do you have a good story on this pillar that you could share with our audience?
Sure,
I oftentimes learn more from the stories than I do from the points.
That's a great question. I think about another example in a prior organization. I had a high-performing team, and as in most organizations, the better results, the better the variable compensation, right? The better the incentive.
Right.
And in this particular company, we were acquired by a large bank, and over a period of time, the bank considered the compensation levels to be almost, they say outside their survey quadrants, right? But, they just thought it was excessive. So they came to me and they said, we want you to cut employees' pay, right? And well, anytime you have to go down that road, it's not an easy process. Especially if I'm the one that, if I'm the leader determining and communicating, the amount of the pay reduction and when and who's impacted. So I got creative. I wrote like one of these Harvard Business Review case study type, formats, and I call it the compensation conundrum. And the case was atypical to our industry, right? And so I described, all the facts, and without them knowing who it was or, who was impacted. And we convened a meeting with our, the division and region managers, and we studied the case together. And then we split them into groups, and their instructions were to come back 3 hours with recommendations. And I didn't give them any say, you have to, do this or accomplish this. I said, here's a case study. Come back and tell me what you would do. They came back and they said, you know what? We need to reduce our compensation levels with our incentive compensation, and we need to reduce it by 15%, right? Well, that was a huge win, right? In many fronts, right? One, we got to where we needed to with the bank. Two, we got, inside of their boundaries on the compensation. But more importantly, we built, consensus and trust. And it was
right,
because it was their idea, right? And and they could accept it. They were able to communicate. I mean, ultimately, I had to communicate it, but they kind of laid the groundwork, and in doing so, you know, it was really a great outcome.
Yeah, I love that. It's, you know, oftentimes getting the results we need, it's not knowing what to do, but it's how to administer what to do, which really gets to your third pillar that I'm really excited to be talking about, doing what's right.
So, you know, I like to be, I'm competitive, and I like to win just like most everybody else. I mean, I'm always hungry, right?
Yep.
But I think it's as a leader, it's my responsibility to protect the team. You know, one thing I probably would least like to do is call up my boss, and everybody has one, whether, you know, and if you're the CEO, you answer to the board, right? So, you know, but to pick up that phone and call somebody and say, you know, we have a problem. You know, we've got a warehouse customer that's $5 million and they're going under, right? And, you know, to prevent occurrences like those, you know, surfacing, I think it's incumbent upon us to, you know, as leaders, to always focus on doing what's right. And if I protect the organization, then I'm protecting the employees and I'm protecting the shareholder. I reflect back on, I was boarding a prop plane one time. You know, you walked up you walked up the steps. That's how small it was.
Yeah.
And I asked the pilot, I said, do you ever worry about all the lives of these people behind you? And he said, no. He said, I focus on doing my job right each and every time so that I land the plane. And if I land safely, everybody else is safe too, and everybody else lives. And so, you know, that kind of, you know, philosophy stuck with me. There's another book that I like, John C. Maxwell's 21 Laws of Irrefutable Leadership, right?
Yes.
He's got the one called The Law of Navigation about two explorers that were on a race to reach the South Pole, right? One guy did the extreme preparation, right? While the other used unconventional equipment, you know, took an extra person along, had inferior clothing, and so on. And the outcomes were polar opposites, no pun intended. One guy made it 30 days before. The other one made it, but on the way back, all the other members perished. So that leader didn't do the right things. He made commitments for himself and others without really fully understanding the conditions and thinking through things that they were going to endure. And I think, in that example, he failed himself and his team. So with respect to doing right, you know, it's always, you know, my foundation is about being ethical and thoughtful. That builds a solid foundation. And when you set high standards for yourself and have high expectations for yourself, you increase your chances of being successful leading teams. So, you know, I've seen throughout my career many examples of people, you know, failing because they lied, they cheated, they made bad loans, or, you know, they lost too much money. I've seen a whole lot less fired for not making enough profit, right? So, you know, if you get the foundation right, and, you know, back to, you know, Mancioni's book, you know, trust is the foundation of that. So those three, you know, pillars help build and facilitate trust, you know, creating a vision, being vulnerable, and doing what's right. And, you know, that's kind of helped me be successful doing what I've been doing over the years.
Yeah, for a long time and doing well. Let's get around to our regulars. I'll start with you, Joe, and then I'll head over to you, Alan. Joe, any questions you have for Ken?
Yeah, on that last one, doing what's right. We in the mortgage industry have so many people who are compensated 100% based on closing a loan, which gives you a little bit of a conflict between, you know, if I get this loan closed, I get paid. If I don't get paid. So when you're dealing with customers who are taking out warehouse loans from you, do you try to get into whether or not your customer employs that kind of pillar in how they do business?
You know, that's a good question. First of all, in assessing the business, right, I mean, we can't be the determinant of whether we like or dislike your compensation program. We have to make sure that, you know, it follows the SAFE Act. But I can tell you that, you know, in my warehouse lending career, there has been at least one example that I'm thinking of where we did not do business with the company because of how their compensation program was structured. And so I think the other, you know, thing, Joe, is that, you know, when you're managing a portfolio of companies and you have the range of different styles of leaders, you know, it presents an opportunity that when you see things, you can reflect back on your experience and offer some tips and ideas to people to help them. I think, you know, the segment that we target is the small to mid cap mortgage banker, and often there's a pretty significant void of structured leadership within those organizations. There's well-intended business owners that, you know, some do it better than others, but, you know, many get lost in the day-to-day activity of, you know, doing the next loan and closing the deals. And to be successful today at, you know, whether you're a small non-bank or, you know, you're in the courier business or any other business, you know, any kind of small business, it's important that you take the time to develop a culture of developing people within the resources that you have and the budget that you have. And, you know, I think you can have something more formal if you're a larger organization and have the resources, and that could be management leadership development programs that, you know, you pick up from the outside or industrial psychologists or professional coaches or mentoring. Or if you don't have all those resources, you know, you can do some more informal things. Like there's some great webinars on LinkedIn. There's TED Talks. There's I'm a fan of the, you know, I call them MOOCs, massive open online colleges, right? They're provided by major universities that provide free continuing education that you can actually get certificates for CEs for. And so those are some of the things that, you know, I think you can do to help strengthen your organization.
Alan, your neighbors there, you guys down with that, you're both in the Ponte Vedra Beach area, so you get to interview one of your neighbors.
Yeah, good to talk again, my friend. We had lunch last time, which was great. Thank you. So, you know, leadership comes in all sizes, and an organization, you know, we're focused a lot in general, and then we're focused on the loan business. But, you know, it's such an important project management and technology and just operational staff for them to understand that someone supports the vision. That's, at times, that's where a lot of the chaos happens. So any tips or suggestions for the sort of the middle of the road, especially pertaining to our industry?
So I think it gets back to, you know, communicating, right? And that's easier said than done, but it's critical to building, you know, what I said, trust, but also it's critical to building cohesiveness on the team. And, you know, I know there's a lot of things that go on day to day, you know, that and distractions that occur. But, you know, I'm really a proponent of having regular formal meetings. We do things within our group called business unit reviews. And no matter what level you are in our warehouse organization, you have a part in that formal presentation called a business unit review. And so, you know, when you engage people and you have them participate at all levels of the organization, you know, that augments your ability to communicate and get a clear, consistent message across your organization. You know, communicating is one thing, you know, that's me talking to you, but as the leader, it's just important. And I chuckle when I say this because it's easier said than done, is to be a good listener, right? Because just talking to you is a one-way dialogue. Listening to your team and staff says, I hear you and I value your input. But listening doesn't always mean I adopt your ideas or concepts, right?
Yeah, that's
and
good.
I agree.
Good distinction.
Hey, Ken, I did hear somebody say something one time, which was, I thought, very empathetic. It was, we're all human. I make plenty of mistakes as well. Let's just learn from it and move on. And that sometimes settles because people become nervous in different areas. And depending on, you know, did I let someone know ahead of time that something was going wrong, or did I wait too long? And then that nervousness builds up issues. So anyways, yeah, I agree with you.
Well, you've been very generous with your time today, Ken. I thank you so much talking about the three primary pillars. There's so much more we could get into. One of the books that you turned me on to, and you're a book reader, is John Gordon's book, The Coffee Bean. And I love
yes.
that. Share that principle in that, if you wouldn't mind, real quickly, and we'll wrap it up.
Sure.
But I got that book over the weekend and read it. It's just really good. Talk about the principle of that.
Yeah. The premise of The Coffee Bean is, you know, life is full of challenges and obstacles. And, you know, what happens when you put a carrot in very hot water? That carrot is going to become soft and weakened by its environment, just like we would in a difficult situation. You know, similarly, if we put an egg in very hot water, it becomes hardened and it becomes conditioned to its environment. And, you know, we say, well, we don't care about this and all those types of negative thoughts. Alternatively, you know, the coffee bean, when you put it in very hot water, over a period of time is transformed into coffee, right? So it goes with
right.
life and leadership, right? We are influenced by our environments, and that presents choices for us. We become part, you know, we can become part of the negativity, succumb to the adversaries, relent under pressure, or are we going to be transformative and lead others around us to successful outcomes? And I think when we become transformative leaders, we have a positive influence on others and we build long-lasting, sustainable results. So we have a choice of, will you be the carrot, the egg, or the coffee bean?
Yeah, I always said this, managers are like tea bags. You really don't really know what's in there until you throw it in hot water and see the flavors that come out. You can smell it, you think you got it, but it's the hot water that brings out the flavors. I love the book, the concept of the book. So, but thanks so much for joining us again today, Ken. It's been great to have you on. Appreciate your sponsorship and look forward to listening to more of your wisdom and programs up ahead. Next week, folks, we've got Scott Rose of Class Valuation. I recorded the interview this last week. It was a really good interview. I was trying to figure out what's going on in the world of appraisal. It's kind of one of those sleepy areas. Scott Rose's interview will give you some new insights into what's going on as far as innovation in an old area, the valuation process. So be sure to check out. They're using some interesting technology, one of Alan's favorite topics. You'll want to listen to next week's podcast. Don't miss it. So we'll see you back here next week. A special thank you goes out to our sponsors, Black Knight Open Mortgage, Resex Warehouse Lending, a division of United Bank, and then also MBA, the Lenders One Cooperative, as well as the Mortgage Collaborative Cooperative, CMLA, Community Mortgage Lenders of America, Velma, Knowledge Group, Vidyard, and AI Assist. Thank you for listening, and have a great week, everybody. See you back here next week.
You've been listening to Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Transformational Mortgage Solutions. Join us next week, and thanks for listening.